I'm Andrea Blythe, co-host of New Books and Poetry, a podcast of the New Books Network. Today, we're speaking with Emily Jungmin Yoon. Emily is the author of A Cruelty Special to Our Species, published by Echo in September 2018, and Ordinary Misfortunes, the 2017 winner of the Sunken Garden Chapbook Prize by Tupelo Press and selected by Maggie Smith. Her poems and translations have appeared in The New Yorker, Poetry, The New York Times Magazine, Korean Literature Now, and elsewhere. She currently serves as the poetry editor for The Margins, the literary magazine of the Asian American Writers Workshop, and is a PhD student studying Korean literature in the Department of East Asian Languages and Civilizations at the University of Chicago. Welcome, Emily, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I am super excited to be able to talk to you today about your book, A Cruelty Special to Our Species. But before we launch into that, I would like to talk a bit more about your journey and towards becoming a poet and publishing your book. So how did you first start to engage with poetry, both as a reader and a writer?
So I've loved poetry since I was very young. And I got into poetry, quote unquote, more seriously in high school when I had a really good creative writing teacher. His name is Terrence Young. He's retired now, but I took a writing class with him in 11th grade or in 10th grade. I don't remember, but he's mainly a poet, and just his enthusiasm and support for poet students really propelled my passion for poetry forward. And that just became my favorite thing to do. I would go home after school and start writing. Or if I was walking around at the street and observed something cool, I would think about how I would transform that into poetry. So yeah, I think that's when I really got into writing a lot. And my passion for poetry just kind of exceeded that of writing anything else.
So what was your journey? Like, what was the first piece you ever published and how did you get there?
So in high school, I published a couple of poems in a youth journal called the Claremont Review. And I didn't write that much in college because I was just too busy, like, keeping up with just all the other classes and just having new social lives and everything. But my first publication, my first, I guess, national, like, adult-oriented journal that I published in was Apiary. Actually, that was in my senior year of college. And it's a magazine based in Philadelphia.
Great. So I was also curious because I, over various places, I heard a lot of discussions, back and forth discussions regarding the value of MFA programs to poetry and literary careers. So as somebody who's gone through an MFA program and graduated from one, I'm curious about your personal experience with that and what value you found.
Right. So I attended New York University from 2013 to 15. And before that, I have to admit, I was very naive about just the whole MFA system. and I didn't really have a lot of expectations. I just decided to apply because I wanted a concentrated time in which I could just write prolifically. And actually, I went to NYU and whatever expectations I had were exceeded. I just met so many people who really helped me grow as not only a poet, but also a person. And being in New York was really helpful as someone who wasn't very in touch with the contemporary poetry scene, because New York has so many literary events going on every day. So it was really easy to, you know, quote unquote, catch up. And I just had a wonderful time. And I had Kimiko Han as my thesis advisor. At my last semester, and it was really wonderful having her, having an Asian woman as my advisor to look over my manuscript with that shared sensitivity and knowledge of East Asian history. So that was really wonderful. And I did have an opportunity to teach an undergraduate class in creative writing, which is also very helpful as well as someone who does want to teach in the near future. Yeah, but I do think that a lot of people ask if they need to get an MFA or if an MFA is a must in order to be a writer. And I absolutely don't think that. Maybe if the person wants to teach in an academic institution, it is helpful to have a degree because administrations usually require them anyway. But yeah, I just think that it's important to find a community, and it doesn't have to be in a school.
Yeah, I didn't go through an MFA program myself, but I love the idea of going through a program just because of the sense of community that it potentially has to create.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a great resource for many people, especially for someone like me who just came fresh out of undergrad and didn't really know what she was doing. But, you know, there is community out there. There are a lot of workshops and retreats that are not in academic institutions, and I think they can be just as helpful.
Great. So now that we've brought up to here, let's come back around to a cruelty special to our species, which I absolutely loved for how multi-layered and lyrical and beautiful it is. And one of the core subjects is the discussion of comfort women. And I'm not, I believe it's after World War II. So I was wondering if you talk about what inspired you to talk about the subject and to put this book together as a whole. And maybe a little bit about the history for those who might not know much about it.
Sure. So the comfort woman is a euphemistic term for sex slaves of the Japanese Empire. So they were actually forced into slavery in the late 30s and early 40s in the Japanese Empire's wars, the Pacific War and the Russo-Japanese War. So it was actually before the Second World War, and thus before the liberation of Korea and Japanese colonies. And we still don't know everything about their history. I think we don't even have the exact number of women who became comfort women, and the range of numbers is very big. Some people estimate that it was 20,000 women. Some people estimate that it was 400,000 women. So that is quite a range. And I decided to write about their history because it was something that is in the past, obviously, but also very now and immediate in the Korean collective consciousness, because it's an issue that hasn't been, I suppose, quote unquote, resolved yet. There are still rallies every Wednesday in Seoul in front of the Japanese embassy asking for the recognition of their history and reparations. And there are fewer than 40 former comfort women alive in South Korea right now. And I also decided to write about this history because, like you said, their history is, for the most part, not very familiar to people outside of Korea, and maybe people who may not be as, familiar with East Asian history in general. And I was thinking about ways I could talk about things that were important to me culturally, but in a way that was accessible to other people. As in, I didn't want to be didactic or pedantic, and I definitely didn't want like a historian's burden. So I was thinking of ways to engage people with this history and help them access it through emotion. And poetry does provide the perfect medium for that. So that's how I kind of got into that. And I didn't really write my manuscript thinking that it's going to be a project book. And some people have referred to it as such. And, you know, I don't think, I'm not saying they're wrong, but that wasn't really my intent in the beginning. It's just that these poems just kept coming and coming. Mm. And yeah, and they just kind of became the centerpiece of my manuscript.
Yeah, there's a lot of powerful pieces regarding that, that discussion. And some of the pieces I found especially moving were the testimonies. Mm. And I've also found it interesting that these testimonies were pulled from documentary materials. So I was curious about your process of pulling from documentary materials and the fact that you're kind of translating from those materials into poetry, and how you approach that in a way to being respectful to these real life stories.
Right. So the testimonies were called from the recorded testimonies in other books, actually. So I had to do some archival research to really find out about their stories, apart from just historical narratives, right? And so the testimonies were already, you know, recorded, transcribed, and translated by other researchers. And it was a difficult task, I suppose, trying to translate them into poetry, because like you said, I would constantly question myself, like, do I have the right to do this? And how do I do this respectfully? And how do I convey to readers that I'm intending to write poems out of their stories with empathy? And I don't know, I try to transfer them into the poetic space in a way that shows my discomfort doing so. And I think one of the ways that I did it is to kind of visually scatter these words on the page that kind of disrupts the reading process. And a lot of the lines, they're kind of pushed together, or there are gaps in them, and a lot of people trip over them, or they've told me that they've tripped over them when they read them themselves. And I kind of intended for that to happen, to show that, first of all, these are, you know, narratives that make people uncomfortable, and they should feel uncomfortable, but also just my transcribing them into the poetic space was also an uncomfortable process for me, and just trying to engage with the reader in our mutual discomfort was one of my intentions. And I tried not to add a lot of my own language in it, even though sometimes it was inevitable because I had to rearrange some parts of the stories or rearrange some words. But I didn't want to change the actual tale. You know what I mean? And that's something that I had to do with a lot of sensitivity towards the story, and also just thinking about my role here. Because I'm trying to fundamentally retell their stories, not to recreate them for my own purpose.
Right.
But that is something I struggle with all the time still.
I can understand how that would be. In a way, though, you're also helping to spread the reach of their voice further by opening it up to a different audience.
Right. Yeah, I'm glad you think so. Yeah, no, it's really scary writing poems of people, you know, who are not me and whose life that I didn't live.
Yeah, I can definitely imagine that.
Right.
Another grouping of poems, which I believe came out of the chapbook that you put together, are the series of poems that are An Ordinary Misfortune. And they're spread throughout the book and they all have the same title. And I'm always fascinated by the idea of multiple poems with the same title because of how they can reinterpret that title in different ways each time. I love how multi-layered these are in terms of their different approaches to women and the things they have to face in their everyday lives and the fact that they're ordinary and the weird normalcy of these unfortunate events and misfortunes that happen. And I'm monologuing a little bit, but I would love to hear more about these poems in particular and how they came together under the same title allowed you to spin off into so many different versions of this idea.
So the title An Ordinary Misfortune came from one of the books that I was reading on comfort women, and it was quoting another book that said becoming a comfort woman, or like being tricked into becoming a comfort woman, was so prevalent that at a point it became an ordinary misfortune. And I was very struck by that sentence and just that the phrasing of that, an ordinary misfortune, you know, it's just an amazing understatement. Right. But it also speaks to how often it happened and how it was just so ingrained in people's consciousness and their lives. And so I wrote a poem titled An Ordinary Misfortune about the comfort women's history. I believe that's the first poem in the book. Yes. And I just kept going back to that title and thinking about other ordinary misfortunes that are in our lives, especially in women's lives, especially in marginalized folks' lives. So I continued writing poems using the same title, thinking about other misfortunes, other violences against the body. So that's how it came about. And I actually wanted to title my manuscript Ordinary Misfortunes, my full-length manuscript. And one of my friends said, it's no, you have to do something else because it's just, I guess, too much repetition or something. And, you know, not that like I have to agree with everything that other people say, but, you know, I was like, maybe I do need to title it something that gestures elsewhere as well. And I made a chapbook after I wrote my full-length manuscript, and because I wanted that to be more just historically grounded in this specific topic, I decided to name that Ordinary Misfortunes. And the title for my full-length manuscript came much, much later.
How did you settle on the title, Cruelty Special to Our Species, for your full-length manuscript?
Well, I actually tentatively titled it Charge Number One, which is the name of the condom that the Japanese imperial soldiers used against the comfort women. And my agent told me to change it. And she suggested that maybe I could just use lines from other poems that I have in the book and see which one really sticks. And a cruelty special to our species is from one of the poems, Fail Theory. And at the end, it just seemed like it fit, you know, it fit the other poems as well, even though it comes from one poem, because the book really is about the cruelty special to our species as human beings.
Yeah.
And, you know, the book doesn't have to be about the comfort women's issue only. And I think that especially in the last section, I tried to gesture toward something more personal or something that has to do also with our environment. So, yeah, I thought it just fit the book.
Yeah. And speaking of that last section, it does shift the book as a whole a little bit by talking about more modern concerns, like you mentioned, environmentalism and various recent things that have happened and so forth. So in terms of it also, that last section feels seems to shift the tone in terms of feeling hopeful in some ways. Like,
right.
And so in terms of organizing the book, can you talk a little bit about how those poems came together and how it echoes the rest of the book while bringing it into the modern?
Yeah, I did try to go into tenderness more in the last section, and of course, in deal with contemporary, more recent concerns as well. But also talk more about my personal experiences and hopefully to suggest some kind of pathway into the next manuscript, although I'm not working on it right now. And yeah, the organization of the book was difficult to figure out. The ordering of poems is really one of the most challenging things of putting together a manuscript, I think. And the last section, in a way, felt kind of natural. Just the way that these poems tonally came together, like you said. Mm-hmm. And also, I think that it suggests our cruelty not against just other human beings, but also other bodies, non-human bodies. So in a way, I'm hoping that the last section kind of expands on what we've been thinking about up to that section and just our various cruelties in our society, and think of it as something that we're inflicting on the greater world as well.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
yes, for sure. and the last poem in the book, Time in Wales, mm-hmm. Has this beautiful exploration of this natural element while also playing with language and looking at the roots of language and how words can have one meaning while also having other meanings. And I noticed that that was a theme throughout the book, the play of language and the way words can have multiple meanings. So can you tell us a little bit about the way you approach language in this way and what draws you to the multiple meanings and the depths of what language can reveal?
Yeah, that poem is one of the later poems that I wrote while working on this manuscript. And so it means my meditations on language and poetry are fairly recent. Thinking about how to incorporate Korean and my Korean background into my English language poetry, it has been a more recent obsession. And I think about that a lot, self-translation into poetry and what it means to me to write in English while being a bilingual person, someone with a Korean family and all that. And I think a lot about how maybe I am a poet writing in the English language because I'm a Korean speaker, someone who was raised speaking Korean, who grew up in Korea for the first like 11 years of my life. And I do think that Korean informs my poetic language, just the kind of acuity to language. By that I mean, sometimes when I am looking at something, maybe I will describe it in Korean, or I'll think of a Korean word for it or a Korean expression for it. And there are times when I'm like, oh, I can't really translate that back into English. But that kind of confusion or the gap between two languages is like a ground very rich with poetry. You know what I mean? Like putting something that you don't have words for into words in a way that like other people can see it too, the way you see it. That kind of click is really satisfying. And I think all poets feel that, not just like bilingual or bicultural poets, but finding that way in language, putting imagery, etching it in a way that other people can see it when no one really could before. And well, not only that, I did really actually come into poetry in high school, like I said before, because I think I had this nervousness about English. Even though at that point I was fluent, I was still making a lot of errors and had a lot of self-consciousness about my speech. And in poetry, you know, there was really no way I could fail in English. First of all, you know, I don't have to speak it out loud, even though at readings people do. But, you know, first of all, it's like a textual presence.
Yeah.
And in poetry, just breaking of rules is more than welcome. So in a way, yeah, like being Korean, speaking Korean kind of really helps me or informs my poetry in ways that I didn't consider until maybe a year ago. And that's something I'm still thinking about. Does that answer your question, or was that just something
That was wonderful. That was it exactly. I love that. And I love what language can do as well. And it's one of the reasons why I read poetry, because of the way it can reveal emotion and describe experiences in a way that nothing else can. So I think you expressed it wonderfully.
Right. I mean, exactly. We're all translating the world in our own language, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In terms of the poems in this book, is there a particular poem that is like a favorite to you or stands out as well representative of the collection as a whole that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I have a few that that are particularly close to me. I mean, I love all my poems. I love all my children, but
yes, of course.
there are some poems, right? There are some poems that I feel particularly maybe tender about or intimate with or even scared of. So like, not to say they're like the best poems or like my favorite poems, but you know, poems that are kind of born out of a sense of vulnerability. And I think the first poem in the book, The First Ordinary Misfortune, is something that kind of really launched this manuscript into existence. One, because it is part of the prose poem series that permeates throughout the book, and also because it's about the comfort women, but also I think it has that kind of contemporary concern in it, just like the question of my role in revisiting and re-narrating this history. And Bell Theory is another one that is very close to me because I, well, for obvious reasons, because it talks about my failures in English and the consequences. I feel very close to that poem as well.
Would you like to pick a poem to read for us?
Yeah, maybe I'll read An Ordinary Misfortune, the one that I just mentioned.
Sounds great.
Okay. An Ordinary Misfortune. Mine is the jam-packed train, the two-week cocktail, the statement by an American man at the bar. Your life in Korea would have been a whole lot different without the U.S. Meaning, be thankful. This question by a Canadian girl, a friend. Why don't you guys just get along? The guys, Japan and Korea. Meaning, move on. How do I answer that? Move on. Move on, girls on the train. Destination, comfort stations. Things a soldier can do, mount you before another soldier is done. Say, drink this soup made of human blood. Say, the Korean race should be erased from this earth. Tops down, bottoms up. Things erased, your name, your child, your history. Your new name, Kumiko, Hanako, Yoshiko. Name of the condom, charge number one. Name of the needle, compound 606. Salverson means an arsenic to save. Ratio 291. 29 soldiers per girl. Actual count. Lost. Lost. All. Shot. 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 Everybody. Give thanks.
Got chills hearing you read it.
Thank you.
It's a very powerful piece. And one of the many things I like about it is the way that it illustrates how the history is not really dead. It echoes through to the modern time. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And it's also the act of creating a poem in this way is kind of an un-erasure, a taking back of the erased and bringing it back up into the light.
Right. And I am thinking about at what point does an event or something become history rather than a present concern, right? Because we do think about, I mean, I do think about the comfort women as like a historical thing that happened to these women. Obviously, that's in like our collective knowledge in Korea, but it is still going on. Like this, their history is still alive, and we're still trying to speak about it and speak it aloud and, you know, push against revisions in that history. And
right,
yeah, it's a complicated question. I don't have answers to it, but yeah,
I don't know that there are easy answers to it, but
right, I guess there shouldn't be.
yeah. So, as we're talking about your poetry and poetry in general, and bringing stories to light, I'm curious about your thoughts on the impact that poetry can have on the wider world, and what sort of a role it plays in terms of attempting to create change in the world.
I'm thinking about poetry as a space in which master narratives maybe don't allow. By that I mean, of course I'm writing about, in my poetry, this history that is very much present in my life and in Korea, but I think poetry is this amazing space in which multiple narrators and narratives could exist at the same time, right? In a way that other prose writing maybe doesn't allow with as much freedom, because each poem can be a can be from the perspective of a different person, where each poem can have multiple narrators. So in a way, poetry is where like these infinite lives can team. And I think that it is a space in which we could look into the archive of these lives that maybe that we are not familiar with because it's not in a lot of other records. And we can access them through emotion, through empathy. And I think that is a really powerful effect of poetry. I'm thinking about, for example, Myung-mi Kim's poetry, in which, you know, her poetic voice is very complicated, and some people might say like abstract, but you know, she has these voices that are not in history textbooks. Like, for example, a Korean woman who lives in Russia, who fled there, and is still living there and hasn't been to Korea. And her Korean language is also a little bit different, a little bit arcane. But these are voices that we wouldn't really encounter very easily in other mediums, I think. But in poetry, it's allowed to put in language that is not the standard language. It's celebrated to record lives that are not, you know, broadcasted in other prosaic ways. So I think poetry is a really important document, or poems can be important documents in filling in gaps of history, and also accessing them again through emotion. But also I'm thinking more about the function of poetry to not just inform, but also to, in a way, deny the world, if that makes sense. Like, of course, I value poetry that fill in gaps in our knowledge, our historical knowledge, like I just said. But I think there is some kind of disdain towards poetry that is just, you know, about nature, like flowers or romantic love. And a lot of those poems are also, a lot of those poems written in more simple, universally appealing language is called Instagram poetry or like Tumblr poetry. And it's not allowed the same kind of legitimacy. But I think those poems are also needed. The poems that heal us, the poems that we can just enjoy with ease and pleasure. I think, you know, poetry can do so much than inform and mobilize and push some kind of agenda or narrative forward. So, you know, that's what I'm thinking. Like, there is a poem for every occasion and every feeling.
Yeah, that we can make space for each type of poetry, that these Instagram poems have a space, and the more complex abstract poems also have a space because they're each saying and doing different things.
Right. I mean, their popularity just speaks to the fact that, you know, maybe every single person does enjoy poetry. You know, everyone has the capacity to enjoy poetry. We've just been exposed to too many bad poems or too many bad instructions about how to read poems, that a lot of people are like, oh, you know, we don't have time for poetry in this day and age, or a poem doesn't really do anything, or this poetry is out of our reach or out of our concern or whatever. But, you know, who doesn't want beauty? Who doesn't want like magic all the time?
Absolutely. I think we're going to get close to wrapping up here. You mentioned that you're not working on your next poetry collection just yet. So do you want to talk about what you are working on?
Yeah, I'm not working on my next poetry book like with a lot of activeness right now because I am trying to devote a lot of my energy and time to promote my first book and give space to that. I'm working on a chapbook of translated poems. It's coming out early next year out of Tilted Axis Press, based in the UK. It's titled Against Healing, and it's a chapbook of poems by 9 Korean women poets that I translated, and it's part of the global feminism series that the press is working on. So I'm in the finishing stages of that, and I'm also trying to write a dissertation proposal in my department here at the University of Chicago. So yes, so I'm doing those. Good times.
Okay, that sounds great. All those sound great. That chapbook sounds amazing, and I'm definitely going to have to buy that when it comes out.
I'm excited about the chapbook for sure.
Yeah. And a dissertation sounds like an incredible amount of work that
I don't know what I'm doing.
I can't even imagine.
I mean, it has to come out some way or the other sometime. So hopefully.
I'm sure you'll get it done.
maybe.
Well, one last question. What is something that you're reading or some sort of media that you're consuming right now that you find moving or inspiring?
The first thing that came up was something maybe that is not a really cool answer. But on Netflix, I watched, you know, season 3 of We Bare Bears. And do you know We Bare Bears?
I unfortunately do not.
Oh, well, it's like a cartoon.
I kind of figured based on the title.
Right, it's a cartoon. I don't know if it's geared towards children. I mean, I suppose it is, but I have enjoyed it very much. It's a story of 3 bears. One's a polar bear, the other one's... Oh, one's a polar bear, one's a panda bear, and the third one is a grizzly bear. And they're all brothers. I don't really know their backstory because Netflix only has season 3. But
so
I love it because, it's about a chosen family in a way. They're like different species of bear, but there's interspecies friendship and brotherhood. And the other characters in the cartoon are also, they're from various backgrounds. It's very, as people would say, diverse. And so, I mean, I think it is representative of, well, this is silly to say. I was going to say, like, the society that we live in, like, urban centers like San Francisco where it's set. But, we don't have talking bears in our real world. So what am I saying? But I watch it because it's very cute and it's very healing. And also, it has representation without hitting people over the head with it. Like, oh, here's, like, a token gay person or a token Asian person. It's just a very... It's a natural part of the narrative. So I enjoyed that. I read a lot of contemporary Korean women's poetry recently for the translation project, but also for my dissertation. And I revisited Kimia Soon's poetry, whose poetry has been translated by Don Mitre very well and has been published by Action Books and has been doing very well. But I really enjoy her poems because they're so bloody and so surrealist and fantastical, but also, you know, a lot of the poems are, you know, very critical of current events and, in a way, obsessed with death and spirituality a little bit, but in a way that just fills me with energy, not like with dread, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense to me.
With the vibrant imagery. Yeah. So, yeah, I really love her work and I recommend her books to other people. And I can do so because there are English translations available.
That's great. thank you so much for participating in this interview. It's been a delightful discussion. I love your book and I wish it wonderful success as you continue to promote it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving me space to talk about poems and about my book.
You're most welcome. This has been New Books and Poetry, a podcast of the New Books Network. Thank you so much for listening.